Hello, and welcome to the ASB Investment Podcast, the show that keeps you up to date on the market and helps you make smart choices with your investments. These are entirely our own views and that of our guests. It's not investment advice, but we know plenty of experts at ASB that will be happy to chat if you need. Well, welcome to the latest episode of the ASB Investment Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Nigel Grant, and today we'll be doing things a little bit differently. We'll be having a two-part extravaganza for this episode, and when I say two-part, I mean kind of like a lovely entree followed by a sumptuous main course, all as part of a single podcast episode. And you certainly can't accuse us here of not being at the cutting edge of media and broadcasting. Now, part one is going to focus on the launch of the new, and drumroll please, ASB KiwiSaver Scheme and ASB Investment Funds, Aggressive Funds. And it's just such a delight to be able to say that to our listeners here because we know many of them and our wider customers have been asking for these specifically for some time. And then in part two, we're going to speak to investment manager Devon Funds Management to discuss the past couple of years, and one could also say, you know, fairly lackluster years or recent period when it comes to returns with respect to the Australasian equity market. But without further ado, we'll get started with our first segment, talking all things aggressive funds. We have two guests up first here in this first segment. If you're a frequent podcast listener, the first guest is well known. He's ASB's head of asset management, the man who's like a AAA credit rated bond. It's none other than Mr. John Smith. How have you been, John?
I'm very well, thank you, Nigel. Happy to be here again.
It's good to have you. And last time we spoke, you mentioned the cherry blossoms across your lifestyle block were starting to bloom at this time. What's new in terms of developments on the farm?
Nothing in particular. It's just spring's carrying on. There's just lots and lots of flowers around. I love this time of year. I love the flowers, love the colour. It's just very relaxing. I'm really, really looking forward to summer.
I've been particularly enjoying. I feel like I'm getting included more and more in the circle. I'm seeing more pictures of your garden. And yeah. As a gardener, yeah, it's very nice to see.
It is a lovely garden.
And our second guest is someone who usually works behind the scenes, making sure our wealth products are meeting our customers' needs, designing new ones, and working through all the nuts and bolts of virtually everything on our wealth business. I have the pleasure of working with him every day. It's a welcome to Mr. Trent Maris. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. It's great to be here.
And Trent, can you tell us, just in terms of it being your first time, expand a little bit more on what your role is and your responsibilities, your role being a senior product manager with us at ASB Wealth.
Yep, that's right. You covered it off reasonably well, but my role is about two things, really. So that's meeting all our regulatory and compliance obligations in relation to the products. And then the other more exciting side is developing the products. So looking for opportunities to improve them. That's things like new funds or improving our online experiences, things like that.
All right, thanks for that, Trent. And it's an absolute pleasure to have you here with me and John for the first time. Now, into the first section here, as a business, ASB has been doing a lot of work in the background to introduce an aggressive fund option for both our ASB KiwiSaver scheme and ASB Investment Fund product ranges. Trent, could you tell our listeners a little bit more about the aggressive fund and I guess starting out simply, what is it?
Yep, so the aggressive funds they're new options for both our KiwiSaver and investment funds customers. So they have target investment mixes or benchmarks of 95% growth assets and 5% income assets. So like all our other funds, the actual mix of growth and income assets will vary based on our short-term expectations to outperform that benchmark. And the ultimate goal of the funds is to improve long-term performance for our customers, provide better outcomes.
And so it's just a quick laser in on that question. It's has more growth assets than a growth fund, correct?
Correct.
Okay, right, cool. Just, I guess in terms of this section of the podcast, we probably might go 101 as such for some components for some investors, just to make sure we get it all out and there's sort of no question left wanting. One of the questions that's been coming through from staff is around the name specifically, aggressive. You know, I always think of the you know, cliche investment gag, passive aggressive, which I often hear sometimes. But why is this word used to describe funds like this versus other types? And what are some of the misconceptions behind what it is not?
Yeah, sure. So it goes back to that higher allocation to growth assets. So aggressive funds will typically have at least 90% growth assets. The way that ties into the name is that growth assets we typically expect to have to outperform income assets over the long term. But we also expect them to be more volatile, so to experience more ups and downs over the short term. Those two characteristics, they're more aggressive asset allocation and expected increased performance and the increased volatility land on the word aggressive.
Sure. And just, I guess, to build on that as well, the
the naming convention, or the I guess the word aggressive, is actually, correct me if I'm wrong, well, I kind of know the answer, but I'm just setting it up for the podcast purposes, the category it's named in terms of what Morningstar talk to this category of funds. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Another similar name is High Growth, is what other managers refer to them.
And so, John, over to you, just to keep the conversation going. You know, I guess we've all been working for quite some time together, all of us three, but you know, can you just build on what is some of the reasons or the main reason behind the launch specifically of an aggressive fund for us, and how will it benefit customers?
Yeah, so an aggressive fund, as Trent was saying, an aggressive fund is 95% or more than 90% growth assets, and growth assets are basically shares, right? Shares and property assets, for example. I suppose the reason for us launching an aggressive fund is because this is basically a gap in the market. Essentially, we have a growth fund. It's the highest volatility, highest risk, highest return over the long run expected fund that we have, and there are groups of customers who have comfort with higher volatility from their investments, and also have just long time frames. And if you have a long time frame, growth assets, the equities assets, are the ones that will give you the best risk-adjusted return over a long time frame. So if you have a long time frame, and we have many customers who do have long time frames, you have customers who are joining KiwiSaver as they enter into employment. And so those customers, you know, to take the maximum possible exposure to growth assets is a sensible thing to do, and so it's really a gap in the product lineup, and we're basically filling that gap.
And to you again, John, the aggressive funds that we're launching all use the same building blocks as the rest of the core funds that customers would know, with respect to both the ASB KiwiSaver scheme and ASB investment funds, and customers will be familiar with that as I said. But you know, so rather than any major divergence around asset classes, you know, tell the listeners why we approach it in this way and the benefits it provides to them.
Well, so we look to give our customers our best thinking for every fund that we have. And essentially, we look at that at sort of like two levels. So our best thinking is both at the asset allocation level, so the amount of growth assets versus income assets, and then the mix of growth assets within that. So we design a specific mix, and we've done that for the aggressive fund. But then at the underlying level, where there is the sort of like the subgroups within the asset allocation, such as global equities or Australasian equities or bonds, for example, we look at those across the suite and say, what's just the best way to invest in those assets? And we think that the best way to invest, for example, in global equities at present is to track an index. And we think that whether you're investing in global equities, whether you're an aggressive investor or a conservative investor, it's simply the best way to invest. So it's, you can understand why we approach it in a way which is similar across the whole suite. There's also another benefit, and that is that that means that we can build scale, and scale means that we can flow that through to lower prices, and so our fees remain low because of that.
Now, some of our listeners might be wondering, who is an aggressive fund actually suitable for? It might not be for me because of my time frame and the advice I've got, but who would be suitable for an aggressive fund? And just before I ask you, Trent, you know, who it is indeed suitable for and what's the best way for a customer to find that out, just for the listeners' context, at about the end of June, or the second calendar quarter, for the KiwiSaver, well, there's no other KiwiSaver market, but the local NZ KiwiSaver market, around $9 billion sits in aggressive funds. So it's not immaterial, and there's a massive pool of customers there that it is right for them in their time frame. So going from that to question for you, who's it suitable for? And then as a second question, or part two for that question, what's the best way for a customer to find out?
Funds like this are designed for those with enough time to ride out short-term volatility and with sufficient risk tolerance to be able to avoid switching funds when they experience that. For our funds, for our aggressive funds, they've got a minimum suggested investment timeframe of 16 years or more, and people also need to have a high risk tolerance to be recommended it. So on the second part of your question, you asked how people can find out if this is right for them. So we have a couple of options. People can get advice through our self-service channels, so that's on the mobile app or Fastnet, or they can speak to any of our staff in the contact centres or advice centres to get personalised advice.
And they'll take you through the steps you need to find out.
Exactly. They'll take you through the steps and tell you if it's suitable for you.
Perfect. And John, as someone who is older than I am, we were talking before, a little bit before we started recording, but do you think the Aggressive Fund is solely for youngies?
Yeah, I often, my natural inclination is to think that the Aggressive Fund is more naturally for younger investors. But I think it's important that people do think that it could actually be suitable for people who are closer to retirement or in retirement as well. Because as Trent said, there is two criteria, really. One of them is having an appropriate time frame.
Yes.
And if you are entering retirement, you still have easily 25, 30 years of life to go, and you need growth assets to battle the sort of like the ravages of inflation. So you need growth assets in your portfolio. And so long as you are closer to retirement and you have appropriate comfort with risk, then the Aggressive Fund can be suitable for them as well. I think that's the key. It's a tool, and we shouldn't be thinking about it as simply a young person's investment option.
And I think even in times like this, when a new fund is launched, even if it is not necessarily right for you on the, you know, those criteria, time frame, risk tolerance, is still a good reminder to even go in and recheck what fund you're in. And as Trent has said, the tools we offer there, through either if you prefer to do it from the comfort of your computer at home, or you can get on the phone, or you can go into a branch, it's all there. So to sum up this section, it feels like a culmination of a lot of work that's been going on behind the scenes for some time. We've been having conversations like this as our team for many months. So I guess being in the studio quite commonly, we're talking about things that might not be as close to customers. This one feels so much rewarding, knowing it's available for customers now. So I want to thank, not just for your time today in the studio, I want to thank you also personally for all the work you've done on bringing this to life. Delighted to be able to say that. John, you're staying on for part two of the show, but Trent, you get the pleasure of fielding the question that I always end our guests on. And so before you go, what's something interesting that you're either reading, watching, or listening to that you can share with listeners?
Yeah, well, like a lot of people, since the sad news of the passing of Matthew Perry, I've been rewatching Friends.
So,
bit of a throwback, but still funny after all these years.
Oh, my beloved wife was a Friends fan from. Have you watched?
Yeah.
Okay. Are you rewatching it?
No.
Okay.
I highly recommend.
Is there anything on? Because did you watch it originally when it was?
I did, but I don't think I've ever watched it in sequence like this. You know, you catch the odd episode at 6 o'clock.
Are you watching it like
watching
from
right
one to
season 1 to 9? I think it is. So, yeah.
And I guess one final question: is there anything? Does it feel? Is it sort of any eerie feelings watching it now, knowing of what happened to Mr. Perry?
It is a bit strange, but you know, it's also good to see. I mean, he's my favourite character, so great to see him in there.
Right,
funny guy.
Well, thank you, Trent. Again, thank you so much for coming along today. Your first time here. We'll get you back one day. But again, you know, thanks for all the information, all the work you've done on this as well, and sort of the guidance you've given to listeners today. We'll see you back shortly at the office.
Thank you.
Now, moving into the second part of the podcast, and it's onto a topic that I'm particularly interested in right at the moment. You may have seen the odd newspaper headline or heard a drive time radio interview or been hit with a question around the dinner table. What's up with the New Zealand stock market? Where has it gone? My dad asks me this because he checks the app on his phone. It's, you know, what has happened to the New Zealand market? And to add to that, it's been a similar issue, probably not to the same extent, but a similar-ish issue across the Tasman compared to other maybe international markets, where the headline index, the 200 or the ASX 200, is, I think I'd said, been treading water before, but Tamo, you were sort of saying it's been a little bit a bit better than that. But so what better than to have someone with us who looks at these two markets every day? And I'd like to introduce our guest from Devon Funds Management. And like Trent before, it's been, I believe it's your first time featuring on the podcast, Tamo Willis, welcome in.
Thank you.
How are you?
Very well, thanks. Pleased to be here.
And we've got John here still as well. John?
Yep.
Okay. Absolutely. You're still sitting here. Tamo, just before we get into some of the key, I guess, macro-level questions, again, if you'd like to tell our listeners on, you know, a bit about yourself personally and what your role is specifically at Devon.
Yeah, sure. So I've been at Devon for 11 years. I run the Trans-Tasman Fund, which is a New Zealand and Australian shares fund. In my early days at Devon, in the first 5 years, I ran an Australian fund. So historically, I've had a career before Devon predominantly in the resources sector. I was covering resources and commodities for some of the big names globally, like GIC in Singapore, Fidelity in London, and also Deutsche Bank in London too as a mining analyst. So I brought a lot of commodities and market experience to my role here at Devon.
Wow. I didn't know you were full resources.
That was the early stage, yes.
Wow.
Now I'm a generalist.
Now you're diversified.
I'm diversified, but I do bring in that experience at certain points because of how big it is in the Australian market.
And so just as an aside, so you would have been covering resources and mining during what I would remember as sort of the big iron ore boom?
The super cycle, yes.
Yeah.
That was during my main phase.
Wow.
Covering resources. Well,
and how was...
It was quite exciting, I'll be honest. It was, at the early stage, China produced 80 million tonnes of steel when I first started my career, and towards now it's over a billion. So
there was
that big, exciting period of very strong growth plus very high prices. And that gives you perspective on there are cycles in everything, regardless of the strength of demand. Supply always responds.
Yeah. I just always had this, the visualization of basically the shifting buckets of Australia over to there.
Yes. That's
incredible,
exactly right.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yes.
And so in terms of our, I guess, our first area of topic, at a macro level, let's start there. Tama, why do you think, what's been driving what we'd say is the underwhelming performance in NZ, and then any further commentary you have on, Australia, what do you put that primarily down to?
Yeah, I suppose when you look back from a longer term point of view, from about 2012 right through to 2022, we had interest rates trending lower, right down to 0.25% in New Zealand at the low. We had pretty strong GDP per capita growth. We had a lot of net migration. So we had reasonably strong growth, and we had very low inflation. So for companies, limited expense growth, plenty of employees, good revenue growth because we had strong GDP growth, and interest bills going down consistently with anything they wanted to invest in, also the interest rates.
So like a Goldilocks.
So almost a Goldilocks for a decade. And at the same time, we did have companies like the Gentailers, the utilities here in New Zealand, listing at very attractive rates, and they gave very strong returns. So we had a lot of really interesting company-specific stories too that did well. If you look at the last 2 years, what has changed? Well, it has been quite a big change in a short space of time. We had, after COVID, we had obviously inflation getting out of control globally, linked to all this fiscal stimulus, the central bank stimulus, but also just the consumer spending that we saw, and the supply chains that there were issues globally linked to COVID. So we've had rates go up very sharply. So interest bills have gone up. GDP growth has started to slow. So your revenue growth has been slowing while your inflation's been high. So almost the opposite, but it's happened in 2 years. So in a sense, it's not a surprising New Zealand's more interest rate sensitive market's been under pressure. Across the Tasman has done actually better because it has quite a different mix of the equity market. Resources are 25% of the market, banks are 25%.
Yeah.
And in the early stage of that rate hike cycle, some of those businesses actually did quite well. So Australia's been up, including dividends, the last couple of years, while New Zealand's been down. But New Zealand outperformed Australia the 10 years prior.
Right, so I guess it goes back to everything's moving in cycles.
Everything's moving in cycles,
right.
Yes.
So, some of the interesting thing about that is very much about cycles, and I suppose my reflections are that the shape of the New Zealand and the Australian markets is that they're very commodity exposed, which is actually quite a cyclical
yes.
thing, and they're also increasingly exposed to China, right? And
yes.
and of course, if you think about the global economy, China is relatively weak, and the part of the cycle we're in at the moment is commodities are relatively weaker. So I suppose in a much more macro sense, it sort of feels to me as if it's not that surprising that relative to the global markets, the New Zealand markets and Australian markets are perhaps underperforming a little. Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, I think particularly, New Zealand, whilst our exports are 30 to 40% to China, and a big part of that is dairy, we actually have... Australia has a much greater proportion of listed commodity companies. So in Australia, probably 30 to 35% of the index is either hard commodities like iron ore, coal, or oil. New Zealand, it's actually less than 10%. So A2, Fonterra. So even though our economy is driven partly by commodity exports, the actual listed market probably has a bigger impact in Australia. than New Zealand, but it is relevant, very relevant for both.
And one thing I've always thought is, you know, sort of NZ, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, whether I've always, you know, this is a misconception or as such, but, you know, New Zealand, parts of the ASX has traditionally been seen as a place to go for higher yield, you know, income paying equities, dividends, that sort of thing. But potentially there's a trade-off there with slower growing companies. You know, if investors have been able to get higher yields on lower risk-free alternatives, we think like term deposits, other things like that, you know, John, what are some of the reasons for staying in Australasian equities?
It's a really, really good question. And it's a very, very topical issue at the moment, the sort of like the attractiveness of shorter-term interest rates. And I think that the key thing I would point out about like a fixed income investment, which is what a term deposit is or a bond, is essentially what happens to the capital over a period of time, right? So you put $100,000 into a TD, for example, or into a bond for 5 years, say, and you take out a five-year TD at 6%, that's great. And you get $6,000 you can spend in 5 years' time because of inflation, and just assuming inflation is just 3% for that per annum for that whole 5 years, you'll need $7,000 at the end of that 5 years to buy the same basket of goods. But you'll only get your $100,000 back. You won't get $100,000 plus a little bit. You'll get $100,000 back. So, and what's more, if inflation has been 3% for that last 5 years, then the interest rates are currently elevated because inflation's high. So if inflation's lower, interest rates are going to be lower. So in 5 years' time, your $100,000, you may have to invest it 4.5%. So you're actually going to be able to generate less income that you can spend on living in 5 years' time off that TD than you are at the moment. So the inflation's really, really important to understand there. So then if you think about Australasian equities, where you can get potentially yields of 4 or 5%, then the other thing that's going on is that the capital that you've invested, that 100,000, is actually growing. So in 5 years' time, that 100,000 could be worth $120,000, $130,000, and all of a sudden, the same yield on that higher amount is actually more money. So you've got more money to spend because you've invested in equities and the capital is growing. It's a really, really important point for people to think of, and it's often misunderstood. And so high-yielding markets, high-yielding equities is a really, really good place to be if you want to live off some capital.
I guess a TD can't put its prices up.
No, it can. Exactly right.
And Tamer, is my long-held, view of those two markets correct in terms of slower growing, higher yielding, or any other thoughts to what John said?
I think John summed it up very well. You know, when we look across New Zealand, Australia, we can invest in either. And at the moment, we do see more opportunities in Australia. But I think you're looking for companies who have the ability to pass on the higher inflation, right, who can grow their dividends over time, who can, you have, you know, products that can grow into international markets. So I think timing the market in terms of now inflation's high and profits maybe a little bit weaker, so not being in the market, I think it's very difficult to time it. And the inflection point when the backdrop changes next year, which, you know, it could at some point, you're best to really invest through the cycle. But I completely agree that if you find businesses that have good quality with reasonable valuations, good growth, able to pay higher dividends as we look forward, pass on cost pressures through to pricing. And that gets easier when inflation moderates, because they don't have to pass on quite as much. So
I think about the amount of times either on Talkback I might have heard, or people have said to me, or you know, the day-to-day conversations, you know, insert thing costs so much more than it used to. Well, to your point, or to both of your points, that's a company passing that on. Therefore, if you're an investor in that company, you are benefiting from that. One final question I wanted to ask in terms of our macro thematic section was around everyone's favourite topic. Well, some people's favourite, some people's probably least favourite, politics. Now, tell me, I guess we don't have to dwell too much on this because obviously we're in a bit of a holding pattern at the time we're recording this, but with the upcoming change in government, how are you and the guys at Devon seeing that?
Yeah, I think it probably just removes a little bit of uncertainty in some areas. I think the you know, government intervention in some sectors may not be as obvious. You also probably regulation may be pulled back a little bit in terms of the onus on investors, on companies, and therefore maybe business confidence might improve at the margin. So, you know, I think slightly more positive for the business sector potentially, but let's see how the coalition
and
comes together.
And I get the sense in terms of reading your facial expressions, it's sort of wait and see, but almost a little bit also muted impact.
Yeah, I mean, generally elections don't have a major impact on equity markets, but I think, you know, in this case, if we can get some sort of Tiwai aluminium deal happening yep. more quickly, that's actually quite positive for our utility sector. So I think there are various things that they could do which would make a difference, but we'll wait and see. It's still early days.
John, anything on politics? Or
My only comment would be that through many election cycles now in my career, really the election outcome doesn't have a lot of influence on the market in the long run.
And invest through it.
Yes,
stay the course.
Invest through it, exactly right.
Now, just the second section of this second section of the podcast, I'm quite excited about, because we're delving into some, you know, quite acute focused topics. And we're going to talk about some specific companies as well. Tama, when we were preparing for the podcast, you called out the importance of China and it remaining key to both the New Zealand and Australian economies. And also it's come, from, I guess, from your background in resource analyst or history. What are some of the key things you're monitoring, or you and the Devon team are monitoring in China and its application back to us here?
I mean, you're exactly right. We talked about earlier in the podcast that the you know, around half of Australia's exports go to China. New Zealand a little bit less, but still almost very substantial. So in that sense, and also given the equity exposure in Australia, we monitor everything. We'll be looking at economic data, government policy, geopolitics are a big watch, and you even see that with the, you know, little skirmishes in the South China Sea, which are a concern for everyone. So, and then we travel to China every year, once a year, just to do a sort of a week. We'll be back there in March again, just to get on the ground snapshot with about 40 different companies. So,
oh wow, that many companies! I dare say there's not much in terms of downtime on that trip.
Not too much, but it's very exciting.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. And I guess in line with that, what or who or anything, are you, I guess, what are you particularly favourable on at the moment and why?
Yeah, it has been, you know, I've been going to China for 20 years, but the last 2 or 3 years, it's been very hard to discern what's actually happening in China, because I think that the government architecture has really focused on, you know, COVID lockdowns. Yeah. It's focused on maintaining the status quo, investing in the state-owned enterprises, managing the private sector more carefully. So within that, it's been quite hard to gauge exactly which direction they're moving in. So that's made it more challenging, especially with COVID. But, you know, we do have a bit of a view on what they're trying to achieve and the potential impact on New Zealand and Australia.
And so do you think, just as an aside, the COVID lockdown or period really was a sea change?
Well, it was. I mean, they were locked down for almost 2 years on and off, over 2 years. So I think the one of the impacts of that has been the consumer sentiment took a, you know, we expected China to really bounce back after COVID, the consumer to spend their savings. What they've actually done is hoarded more of their savings because they've come out of COVID a bit more cautious.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
And so how do you, I guess with that in mind, from a geopolitical and you know, internal borders perspective, one of the numbers that's always thrown about that's really important is the GDP number, you know, hitting a certain target. What are your guys' thoughts, you know, on how they're tracking towards a specific number and why?
Yeah, well, it looks like the government will achieve its 5% GDP growth this year, even though consumption's probably disappointed slightly, it's still growing. Property has been weak for some time. As the government's really focused away from speculation. But yeah. As a result of that, they've had to really push infrastructure, heavy industry, manufacturing investment. So, you know, properties might be 20% of the economy or a bit less. It used to be 30. So that's less important. And the other areas are growing more strongly. So that's how they're balancing. And next year, again, the budget deficit expected to push out to almost 4%. So they're using more of the government balance sheet to underpin growth in some of these areas. So the general mood on the view on the street is they'll target 4.5% growth next year. Some are saying 5% because they really want to push confidence, but that's all speculation at this stage. Probably 4.5 is a safer number to assume until we hear otherwise.
I'm sure some economies would absolutely love 4.5.
Well, they would. I mean, I think the government is very aware that they need to keep growth high because there's a lot of youth unemployment and to keep the economy growing.
And with that push into industry or manufacturing, those sorts of things, is there any specific companies that you're watching, let alone bullish on?
Yeah, well, I think John pointed it out. We talked about the commodity cycles before, and I suppose the iron ore market, which you've asked about, which is, you know, is about, you know, Australia exports 800 million tonnes of iron ore a year.
Wow.
Which at $120 a tonne, you can, you know, it's a very, very large number. And that's actually been very resilient. And it's the same discussion we had on China, is the property market's been weak, but all the other areas are also very steel intensive, and that's allowed steel demand to grow, notwithstanding property weakness. So there's very little new iron ore supply, so the market's very tight. So the price has actually gone up, which is a bit counterintuitive. If you were thinking about risks, you'd think the iron ore price would be weaker, but actually it's been very strong in the last 12 months because of those factors. The other factor, which is interesting, is scrap collection, which is also used in steel production, has been quite weak during COVID.
Right.
So scraps always are used as when prices are high, scrap comes into the market, but it simply hasn't come in, which means you've needed more iron ore. So the big majors, like BHP and Rio Tinto, have actually done very well during the last 12 months, where other businesses, which have been a bit more susceptible to interest rates on the negative side, have done less well. So it just shows you that you really, by looking at the micro and what's happening in individual markets, you're able to then, you're able to invest in businesses that are doing better.
It's fascinating. Cause something, you know, I guess if I'm an avid follower of markets, as probably everyone knows, but, you know, if you follow some commentators, you know, it's either feast or famine for the big majors, isn't it? Like, get out of them. It's everything's dire. Whereas if you, to your point, like you focus on the micro or macro, actually those trains and boats are still getting filled every day.
Absolutely. And when you're a BHP, for example, it produces 300 million tonnes of iron ore close to at $30 a tonne. The price is 110. You know, you can see the sort of margins. Similarly for copper, they're very low cost assets.
Pretty good fundamentals. And from one of the biggest economies in the world, I guess in their never-ending thirst for iron ore, to one of the most important industries in the world, and that's healthcare. So it's a fairly large sector in New Zealand and Australia. And one particularly topical thing at the moment is these new weight loss drugs. I guess I always think of Eli Lilly has been working on them. I think there's the infamous, or infamous probably the wrong word, the Novo Nordisk, I think, is the company that dwarfs the economy.
Norwegian economy, right.
Now. Who would have thought it was that versus the famed oil and gas reserves? So, Tama, how's the focus on these weight loss drugs impacted this sector in our markets?
It's a good question, and it has definitely been one of the big themes this year, has been weight loss drug GLP-1s, as they're called, alongside probably the AI, which we'll talk a little bit later. And I suppose the genesis of this has been the diabetes drugs, also developed by Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk, which have been around for 10 plus years.
And 10 years?
Yeah, they've been around for a long time. And I suppose some of the side effects of those were modest weight loss, around 5%, 5 to 7%. But the new variations of these two drugs, Wegovy with Novo Nordisk and Mounjaro with Eli Lilly, and we're in the US 3 or 4 months ago, and we talked to Eli Lilly about their products and about their aspirations. Now, the key difference is these new drugs, the weight loss is 17 to 22%. The side effects are there, but they're not, you know,
trade-off.
85% of people continue taking them despite the side effects. So they're not large compared to the population percentage. Now, at the moment, there's a few issues. The cost is very high, the supply is somewhat limited because it requires a weekly injection. It needs all the vials and different aspects of that. So new manufacturing capacity needs to be made. But equally, there's a big push for new supply. There's new drugs in the pipeline, which are oral, potentially, and including ones with even higher weight loss percentages. So that's created a bit of a firestorm around the world, and it's almost been, for the healthcare sector globally, it's been, if you're not one of those two, you'll get sold off, and money's repositioned into those two names. So I think we've had the big flow through of that happening, and now the question is really around the analysis of, you know, more analysis on how does it impact each healthcare company that and globally if that occurs, and then also other areas of the economy if you have slim, you know,
like less, PepsiCo,
less obese, Coke. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Fast food, yeah. Airlines, positive, but supermarkets. So I think it's going to take a long time to play out. And what the market often does, and this is creates opportunities too, is it shoots first and asks questions later. And now some of the more, you know, if you look at the studies that are ongoing, there's a study on sleep apnea, which is coming out early next year. There's been a study on cardiovascular impact, because if you weight loss, yes. There's studies on kidney disease. So it's an absolutely fascinating area, and we can see opportunities and risks, and we evaluate that. And one of the reasons we did the trip to the US.
And two of the, I guess, you know, acutely focused on two of the holdings you've got within the mandate you run for us being CSL and Fisher & Paykel Healthcare. Now, can you give, I guess, to your point, like some of the things you've said have already applicable to both of those, but you know, a quick overview of both your investment thesis and what may, is that the reason behind the recent weakness in the share price?
Yeah, I think there's a few factors there. I mean, Fisher & Paykel is, if you look at the shape of that business, about 70% of the business is high flow nasal oxygen into hospitals for things like surgeries. It was used in COVID a lot, and that's very underpenetrated and still growing at 10% plus per annum. About 30% of it is masks into sleep apnea, which is at home use.
While you're sleeping and
sleeping at home use and overnight. And I suppose that's an area that the market's become a bit nervous about, because if you have weight loss in the American population, 110 million obese, what does that do for that business? At the moment, I think the markets are the view that it will just lower growth rates for that area, but it won't send them into reverse. Now, that's a question we're having to evaluate as we go forward. So I think that's part of it. But the other part of it's probably been rising interest rates, rising discount rates, because these businesses have been high growth with higher multiples. I think in the case of Fisher & Paykel, that's probably impacted. But the key part of that business is still growing very strongly. Margins are recovering out of COVID. So while we're underweight relative to the index, we still hold a position in Fisher & Paykel. CSL is more interesting to us because recently had a change of CEO. It's involved in collects blood plasma, yes, predominantly in the US for key disorders like
quite immune, a niche, eh?
Very immune deficiency is the key focus. It has a big flu business, the world's largest flu business. And also recently acquired a business which has an iron franchise plus kidney disease.
Not diet. Iron ore?
No, okay. Iron.
Blood iron.
Blood iron, okay, exactly. Right. And they've been hit by a few factors. One was the CEO changed and they reduced earnings. They still grew over 10%, but reduced earnings from higher levels. And then there was some concern they might be impacted by this, the weight loss drugs in the kidney business. But actually at the edges, there doesn't seem to be material impact, but the stock price sold off. So we see it as a really great opportunity to buy into this business because it's still growing at 15% per annum. We don't see it having any direct impact from the weight loss drugs. So it's one of our top overweights in our portfolio. Right. So we prefer it to Fisher & Paykel, although we do own both. So I think that's an example of where we've seen an opportunity from this situation, and it's started to recover. It's bounced. It's up 15% from the low, and we see that continuing over the next couple of years.
The final kind of topic I wanted to go on, or trend I wanted to look in, was to focus on one of the key trends we discussed on our last podcast, actually, and that was described there as a mega trend, and that's the ongoing digitization of the world, including the rise of the buzzword AI. I feel like this has gotten more prominent since the last episode, with more and more company earnings calling it out, talking about it, tech companies releasing new things all the time to the market, not to mention my LinkedIn feed is now being populated with an ever-increasing amount of quote-unquote AI experts to digitize your business. John, since we last talked on the podcast on that topic, has anything stood out to you, I guess, that you're seeing or hearing just, I guess, broadly in the market on this theme?
Well, there's a couple of things, actually. It's been very interesting just sitting here listening to Thomas speak about the trends that he's been talking about here. And what strikes me here about AI is this, you know, shoot first, ask questions later type. There is a real, it's just an opportunity. Everybody's piling in a market sense. And then this, like, getting into the granularity of what it really means, is something I think that still needs to play out. So I think we're certainly seeing that happening in an AI sense. The other thing that strikes me is the advantage at the moment is very much to the US in this space, because they have the technologies which are the ones that are really underpinning all of this stuff. So there's some real almost geographic benefits being seen in markets as this theme is playing out. But the theme has got to broaden, and there's so much, I think, that you could almost replay of what Tama just said about something that's been in existence for 10 years and all of a sudden has become a massive theme. Well, AI has been around for a very long time and all of a sudden has become a massive theme. So I think it's really, really important in my mind to think a longer term and look through some of this sort of stuff. That's probably the way my thinking's been going on in this. Don't discount the fact that New Zealand could be, we could see opportunities come up in New Zealand in this sense. New Zealand's got a really quite a nice little technology sector. I don't necessarily think we're going to be creating the hardware pieces of that, but New Zealand's pretty strong in software. So I think that's the way to think about this. Think about where the next level opportunities are is probably where I'd be thinking at this stage.
Tama, anything to add?
I think that's exactly right. I think, and we're looking for investment opportunities in Australia and New Zealand related to this. And we'll talk a bit about Goodman Group. We've found we think is a very attractive opportunity to benefit from this, not at an extreme valuation, which is what we're faced with if we're trying to invest directly in a data center company in Australia. They trade at 100 times earnings and are very capital intensive. Goodman Group trades at 19 times but has a $50 billion data center pipeline ahead of it.
And look, let's just get straight into that. So Goodman Group, maybe just explain for the listeners the background to that and anything else you want to build onto your point.
Yeah, I mean, Goodman Group actually owns 20% of Goodman Property Trust in New Zealand. So a logistics player globally with assets focused in the main cities, the very best, biggest, largest cities globally. So it will develop assets and then it has third-party investors. So it will put some of the assets into their funds. It's had a 20-year track record of doing that. And it historically has had very executed on projects with no blow up, no risk, no issues. They're just excellent property developers of the very best quality.
And I always think of, when I think of Goodman, I think of like Highbrook in Auckland. I think driving out there and you see the green signs. So I wouldn't have naturally thought that Goodman was building big data centers. I sort of think of logistics.
Yes, exactly. And logistics has been a very the best of the property markets because of the e-commerce drive, because
COVID,
the big supermarkets and Walmarts and others, increasingly distribution centres right in the middle of key cities, but they have multi-level distribution cities all moving to electric vehicles and different. So Goodman already has the land and the assets, and they often repurpose and redevelop. So we didn't, this is the hallmarks of a very good company. We all knew that Goodman was developing out about $1 billion of data centres a year for the last few years, but quite, not minor, but they came out maybe 6 months ago and said, actually, we've developed a pipeline of $30 to $50 billion. And what that means is across 180 hectares of the very best sites, they've gone and negotiated power contracts, because the key thing for data centres is having the power and the infrastructure to site.
Yep.
So if you can get the site, which they've got, and you then contract the power, you've then de-risked the project, because it takes about 4 years to build out a fully developed data center. So if you're a Microsoft, you'll have heard Microsoft developing here, they'll be scouring the globe for their next site. In some cases, Microsoft will negotiate with third parties who have their sites. Other cases, they'll buy land and develop. But if you're starting from scratch, you'll need to buy the land, find the right location, organize the power, get the infrastructure, and then develop. It could be 8 years end to end. Now, because of this rise in AI and demand for data, they need it now. So Goodman Group came out and said, well, we have the power for 60% of that. We have the land. We have the infrastructure. We're ready to go. So they've they can sign contracts immediately on quite a number of those sites. So very impressive. They've kept it quiet. They've gone around, organized the strategy, and then they've come out and told the market, just as the global logistics market starts to soften. So a very good company.
Skill and timing,
yes.
Man, I tell you, your skill for understanding company by company is tremendous. Look, we're at the end. So I guess I guess I want to thank you both for everything you've offered today and the insights. We have a couple of questions. John will know them well. Tama, first time we'll get to do it. But before we wrap things up, we ask all our guests, Tama will ask you first, what's something you're reading or watching or listening to that you can share or recommend to listeners?
Yeah, I did listen to something over the weekend, which was a video from Robert Friedland, who he was historically was the entrepreneur who found quite a number of copper resources globally, and he was referring to he found Oyu Tolgoi, which Rio Tinto now has, and he's found a big asset in the Congo now. So he's had three major discoveries over his lifetime, and he's made many, many billions from these assets. He is a very big copper bull, so he thinks that everything now we're seeing, both wars, electric vehicles, renewables, drive copper. Yeah. Copper is limited supply. He's less positive on things like lithium because he actually thinks it's everywhere in the world and technology will allow that to be unlocked, whereas copper, it's not. So that was actually, because we do own copper, and I thought that was actually a really good video to watch.
Oh. Hey, I know you're a resource junkie now. That's love it. And John?
I'm a child of the 60s, and so for me, end of the 60s was the first man on the moon, so space flight, all that sort of stuff. So this weekend was pretty exciting because the second flight of this massive rocket called Starship, and I learned the finance industry is not the only industry for three-letter acronyms.
Yes.
I learned a new one, RUD, or RUD. These people straight-faced talked about, this spaceship just went through a RUD.
Yeah.
And what's a RUD? A rapid unscheduled disassembly. Basically, it blew up. So I thought it was fascinating. I loved it.
And it correct me if I'm wrong, it flew much further this time than last time.
It was far better. This time all the engines lit as they should, and it went through stage separation, and the Starship itself got through to almost orbit, but there were problems with both the first stage and the second stage, so they both rudded. It's test and learn, at a very expensive test and learn, but nevertheless test and learn. If it goes wrong, they learn from it and you fix it and then they make it better next time. That's the way they're doing it.
I was just sitting there thinking I'm going to try and weave in RUD at work next time for some acronym. So I'd like to thank you all, or thank you both for stopping by. Tama, obviously it's your first podcast. We hope you enjoyed it.
Very enjoyable. Thank you.
Good.
Hopefully I get invited back.
Well, my notes said here, we'd like to have you on back. We'd like to have you back one day. So we look forward to having you back then. John, as always, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
And to our listeners, we'll be back in a few weeks with our next podcast to close out 2023. So look out for that. In the meantime, thanks for listening. And as always, it's bye for now. Thanks for listening to the ASB Investment Podcast. If you have any thoughts on this episode, or if there's anything you'd like to discuss on a future show, get in touch with us at podcasts@asb.co.nz. Interest in the ASB KiwiSaver Scheme and ASB Investment Funds are issued by ASB Group Investments Limited, a wholly owned subsidiary of ASB Bank Limited. ASB provides administration and distribution services for the schemes. No person guarantees interest in the schemes. Interest in the schemes are not deposits or other liabilities of ASB. They are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of income and principal invested. For more information, see the ASB KiwiSaver Scheme Product Disclosure Statement or the ASB Investment Funds Product Disclosure Statement available from ASB's website and the Register of Offers for Financial Products at disclose-register.companiesoffice.gov.nz and search for ASB.